Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here on The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And what you're hearing is that's I'd Love to Change the World by 10 Years After. Alvin Lee of 10 Years After passed away on this day in 2013. And on with this conversation, I want to remind you The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org, or at SteinerShow.org is the Maryland State Education Association's banner. We are now going to talk about the report that came out on Ferguson from the Department of Justice. We talked just when we learned the other week that that Darren Wilson would not be indicted on federal civil rights charges. We had a conversation about that to understand why that occurred and how difficult it is to indict people on civil rights charges in this country. But the second part of this report is what I think is the most glaring. And that's what we're going to focus on for the focus this half hour. And I want you to join us here at 410-319-8888. Email us at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. But do call 410-319-8888 and what you think of what Eric Holder and company have put out. We are being joined this half hour by Akiba Solomon, who is Editorial Director of Color Lines. And good to have you back with us, Akiba.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Tara Bynum's in the studio, Assistant Professor in the Department of English at Towson University. Tara, welcome. Good to have you back.
Hello.
So Akiba, let me begin with you. This is, I've seen so many people tweeting about this, like, what now? Here's the report. What does this mean? And just your sense of what piece you may be writing and thinking about when it comes to this second part of this report, which is fairly damning when it came to the racism inside the Ferguson Police Department.
I think that the report confirmed what people in Ferguson have been saying for quite some time. And, I think it lends legitimacy to what they're saying. You know, for me, the big question is, okay, what do we do with this information? I mean, my colleague, Carla Murphy, wrote a piece yesterday basically saying that there has not been an actual financial accounting of the institutional racism that occurs in Ferguson. And I think that's a really good point. We don't know how much this actually has costed people. We know, certain anecdotes of people who have lost jobs or, they owe a great deal of money. But the bottom line, for me is, again, what do we do with this information? I think
Right. Pretty
much everybody knows that Ferguson Police Department has some race problems. So what's the next step?
Akiba, we didn't need a report to tell us that?
No. Right. Look, I'm a journalist. It's important to, dot your I's and cross your T's.
Right.
But, I do. And so the report is definitely necessary. But I feel like the report is many years too late. People know. People know. So.
And part of it, when I saw those people talk about these seven racist emails that were uncovered, Tara, and I when I saw that, that was one of the most least shocking pieces of the entire thing for me.
the seven racist emails?
Right,
Well,
because I can see that happens all the time, every day, across this country, within certain segments of almost every police department. It's a joke.
Well, that's what...
Black folks are a joke.
I guess that...
Are joking material for these cops.
Yeah. I think that the fact that the emails exist kind of also lets me know what has always been very obvious is that, and I think this is in many ways the function of white supremacy. Like, they don't have to check themselves. Mm-hmm. They don't have to think, I shouldn't send this email because there could be repercussions. That's not a consequence that those in power have to consider. And I think that's part of the privileges. So I don't know that I was necessarily surprised by the racist mm-hmm. emails. I'm impressed that there were only seven. Like, where are the other thousand? were those people smart enough to hit delete or, at least archive them in places where they could not be found? I think seven is entirely too low.
It made me think that last week when we talked about, earlier this week, when we talked about the prison riots, the rebellion outbreaks in Texas and our federal prisons that are run by private contractors of people who are immigrants. You saw also the same series of emails and texts between the men who are guarding those prisons with the same derisive racist comments about Mexicans, who they were guarding, and how it was fun to beat them up. I mean, so I wonder where, Akiba, where do we start this conversation? We see the kind of horrendous thing that is could be in many police departments where black folks are two times more likely to be stopped and 26 more times likely to be searched, even though they don't find anything in people's cars, to uses of force overwhelmingly against black people who are stopped. And even while Michael Brown was killed for walking, mm-hmm. that there are all these walking regulations and 90% of all the people stopped for walking irregularities are black. So where do we go from here? What does this mean to us now? Where do we take this?
I think there needs to be a real, serious, honest assessment of what is happening. Hello?
You're here. I don't know what that was, but go ahead.
of what is happening, meaning none of this is by mistake. I mean, this stuff is systemic. It is designed to function the way it's functioning. It's actually functioning quite well. So policing black bodies, you know, over-policing black bodies, you know, having racism baked into immigration detention, like that's what this is for. So the question for me really is, what is the incentive to change? If something is being, you know, as functional as this is being, it's really hard for me to imagine that anything is going to change because there's no will to change it. You know, and there's no, I don't feel like there's really at this point any consequence, you know, institutional consequence for this sort of behavior. I mean, you see, you know, one police officer will get fired, somebody else is on administrative duty, but, you know, those are sort of like token punishments. So, you know, I just really think that we need to look at, like, we need to seriously look at what's at the foundation of this sort of policing.
And as you look at that, Tara, I mean, so how do we affect that change? I mean, people talk about how in Ferguson, a part of it is that people need to push the folks in power out of power, and folks have to come out and vote and take city power. But what would that mean in the long run, do we think? A, that would be important to do, but B, you see African Americans in charge of cities across the country where this brutality continues, right?
That's absolutely true. Absolutely true. As I was thinking about it, I didn't necessarily kind of come up with a solution to the problem as quickly as I had hoped. But I did. I guess I was thinking more about, like, how do we take the statistics? How do we take the numbers? How do we take the kind of graphs and charts that data is so often comprised of and turn it into stories of real people? I was teaching on Wednesday, a class full of first-year students, and we were talking about lynching and the history of lynching in America. We had just read Ida B. Wells Barnett's A Red Record, and there was a student who kind of rather benignly said, you know, there are a bunch of numbers here, but I didn't really think about the people until Ida B. Wells Barnett told a story. And in that story, kind of explained what happened to this particular person. And I think we do have to figure out a way to dismantle the powers as they are. And I think part of that process somehow has to be to figure out how to turn people from data and statistics into complex human beings in the ways that they actually are.
You know, that's an important point, I think, Akiva. And I think of the work that you do at Color Lines. And I was yesterday we broadcast a piece that we did with Paul Rucker, who's a fairly nationally renowned artist who has a new show open called Ruined, in which he actually does pull out names of not just those lynched, but those who have been killed by the police, and has a very kind of graphic and an intense artistic response to all of this. Yeah. And one of the people on our program in the last half an hour was the person from John Lewis's office who helped do that graphic novel describing Selma. To people. And sometimes it feels as if those are the kind of things that often make a difference. Somehow you've got to put that out in front to make it real for people so they can go beyond their own experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you're talking about is critical. I think that these sorts of creative interventions need to happen because, you know, people need to be humanized. I do think media plays a big role in how we evaluate these situations. You know, as a member of the media, I've noticed quite a bit that, you know, in a lot of cases, if we're talking about police violence, the police are known as the police. Even if their names are known, people do not use their names. And so it becomes, like, it criminalizes the victim in a way. You know, you only know the victim's name. You don't know who the person was that pulled them over or accused them of being a pedophile because they were sitting in the car, you know, cooling off from a basketball game, and that person ends up losing their job. You know that, you know the civilian's name, but you don't know the police's name. So I think, you know, one thing that can happen is that we need to really name names, and we need to make sure that what we do know, you know, we use that information, because this really is about a human exchange. This is not just some... So, you know, I just think it's important for us to be clear.
So I want to open the phones here and have our listeners come in and join this at 410-319-8888 with your thoughts and ideas. As you look at this police report from Ferguson, I'll just throw out this little editorial thought in my head that when you look at Ferguson, it's like almost because of its being so blatant, it's almost a throwback to the 50s and early 60s. But you see that same brutality taking place in places where that is almost kind of hidden because of, A, either it is now masked in this, we are keeping order and taking care of society as opposed to what's really blatant in Ferguson. So how do you go even beyond where you are now? 410-319-8888. And Lakeisha, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, good day. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Yeah, my comment is, the problem is that if we're supposed to be progressing, you know, within a society, you know, we have all this civil rights, you know, progression, supposedly, policy should reflect that, and that has not been happening. Because we want to make this society as inclusive as possible. And the policies in place have not transgressed or has not, you know, evolved into that. I think that's one of the major problems. I have a son, so, and I don't say I'm African-American because that terminology pretty much don't make sense to me. But I have a son, and I represent that group of people. And it scares me to know that my son has to be in a society where his mother is a, you know, a law-abiding citizen, pretty much follow the rules. And because of how he looks or whatnot, because you have people out there that don't like how he looks or don't like him because who he is, he has to be spared for his life. And I think that's pretty, you know, I don't accept that. And I refuse to accept that. So I'm going to pretty much fight for the changes because it's our right as adults to ensure that our children are protected,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's my aim, to make sure this changed, because it saddens me that our kids have to live in fear. Our forefathers did. Our children shouldn't have to do that. Progression should reflect in the policies, and we need to make that happen as a people. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lakeisha. What are you thinking of, Tara? I look at you contemplating what she was saying.
Well, you know, I think that I am over here thinking about the fact that kind of, I guess I was thinking about MOVE in particular, the MOVE organization in Philadelphia, and bear with me, it'll make sense. So I was thinking about MOVE, and I was thinking about the number of kind of Black Philadelphia citizens that were horribly opposed to the MOVE organization and its kind of engagement with civil disobedience, and they were so angry about MOVE that they called on law enforcement, they called on the politicians to do something. And then the politicians did, and the story ends up being what it is, that the MOVE organization is bombed in three city blocks, an entire neighborhood in Philadelphia is destroyed. And I guess I'm thinking about kind of it returns back to Akiba's point, this idea that there's a very clear need for reform. There's a very clear need for overturning that power structure, and there's also a very real need for policing. So, like, how do we? What does it end up looking like? I guess is what I'm thinking about in the midst of all of this.
Akiba,
I mean, you know, I think the MOVE example is very powerful, and I'm actually from Philadelphia and was a child when that happened and lived maybe 15 blocks away. But, you know, our experience or my experience is that the MOVE people, quote unquote, they were dirty, they were loud, you know, they were threatening, they had a bunker on their roof. Like, this is the kind of thing you've heard about. But, and yes, like law enforcement was called in, people wanted MOVE to be dealt with, quote unquote, but they absolutely didn't. I did not think that MOVE would be annihilated and now three city blocks would be destroyed. And so the question really is, like, how, when you invite law enforcement into your community, how can you ensure that they are there to protect the so-called good guys? You know, and I mean, I must be like, I'm at a loss, because if everybody is characterized as bad guys based on what they look like, then it's really difficult to have any faith in a law enforcement system that is supposed to enforce laws and protect people, because, you know, people, they're not people in their eyes. Everybody's a perp. And I think that is like a really damaging mindset that needs to be changed. I mean, I don't know what the training is. You know, I don't know individually what police departments require new recruits to learn. But I think they definitely need some radical anti-racist training so they can free themselves or at least acknowledge that this thing exists. So,
I think that's important. And I was thinking about it as you were speaking, that a little text I got from producers was that this May is actually, just to throw it out there, is the 30th anniversary of the Osage Avenue bombing with MOVE. This May is 30 years. 30 years. 410-319-8888 is number here. Leo, you're on the air.
Morning, Mark Steiner. How
good morning,
are you?
Leo Burrows. How are you?
Oh, I'm wonderful. Can you hear me clearly?
We can hear you clearly.
Well, good morning to you and your guests. I must tell you that when I hear about the Ferguson report of patterns and practices, it is no surprise. The difference between Ferguson and Baltimore City, where I'm privileged to have been born in 1942, is that we have a black mayor, we've got a black city council, we've got black folks who are in positions of prominence politically, unlike Ferguson, but the results are the same. And I maintain that when you have people, so-called minorities in power, who act like white folks, then we come back to institutional racism and we point the finger justifiably to say, if you've been brainwashed to accept or engage in a slave mentality, if you embrace a slave mentality, then you will continue to be a slave. Look at the towing scandals we've had in Baltimore City. And Lewis Hobson, you remember that, Mark Steiner?
Yes.
Sergeant Lewis Hobson's settlement in 2010 with Commissioner Bielefeld in this city, after 16 years of fighting discrimination against black police officers in the Baltimore City Police Department. Again, what I'm trying to say, and I heard what you said about MOVE, and you're exactly right, but don't forget Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Rosewood, Florida. Even when black folks are passive and nonviolent and succeed in building power and wealth, they may become subject of an attack. Black people have to understand that there are times when we have to physically protect, defend our children, families, and businesses against a physical attack, which can occur even today in America.
So,
we gotta do that, and we don't want to do it. We want to talk about nonviolence. I'm nonviolent at this point in my life, as long as you don't attack me. I've changed in my evolution.
Well, even when I was part of the civil rights movement with you, Leo, way back in the 60s, I was always nonviolent, but until but off the line, I wasn't as nonviolent as I was on that line. But let's pick up what you said. I mean, I think that this question, again, of it's the question of he's raising of what has political power really changed in this process, and what does it mean that the mayor of Los Angeles may have been African-American once, or Mexican-American, or that the mayor of Baltimore is black, or that the mayor of New York once was African-American and now there's a mayor of New York that is supposed to be progressive and thinking about doing things a different way. What does that really mean in terms of this kind of relationship with the police, and how much that is connected to the complete disconnect many people have in communities of color who are isolated and poor in communities that don't come out and are being the ones policed? So where do we begin this now? I mean, we're at the point now in this country where a new conversation has to take place, or a new movement has to take place to address this disparity. Mm-hmm. It's not as simple as just electing folks to office.
No, it's definitely not as simple as electing folks to office. And I think that, I mean, I guess the critical approach that I think is overwhelmingly important is one that, and the last segment mentioned this too, like that actually remembers the history of the country. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's been a way in which that history doesn't seem to exist anymore. So not only do we need to think about Tulsa, we need to think about Wilmington, we need to think about Illinois, we need to think about South Carolina. There's so many places that we need to think about, and to think about in a way that actually suggests that 2015 has not actually produced a new way, but instead continues an old way. And I think that even the mythology of nonviolence, as the last segment suggested, or even this idea that, and I keep coming back to this, like, this is not my grandfather's movement. Like, well, your grandfather was a boy once who may have done the same thing that you did in the movement, but now that he's your grandfather, there's another kind of conversation that you all have, but somehow the old have never been young, and somehow the history has never informed the present. And you know, I think that maybe it's just the scholar in me that wants to say, can we just remember?
Akiba, before we have to take a break here, you want to?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the next one too. We need to remember. Well, we need to learn. And then once we learn, we need to reinforce it, and we need to create a clear timeline. Like, there aren't really any interruptions in what is going on. You know, there's always been racist violence in this country. And it depends, you know, it's like, this is a point where it just depends on who the people are who are committing the violence and getting away with it. You know, so the question for me really is, again, are police departments like Ferguson there to protect people? And I think the answer is no. The same way that police departments were not in place, you know, to protect black folks who were accused of murder and were lynched. You know, that is not mm-hmm. It feels like a very it's a similar idea. So, you know, I think the history is a really important place to start, you know, for people to really understand what the foundation is of what we're dealing with now.
Can we have one quick call to say at the end of the hour with? Let's go to Chucky B in Odenton. Chucky B, we only have like a minute and a half left, but what was your thought?
Yes, good morning, Mr. Steiner and guests. And I've been listening to you good folks, and, you know, what I say is out of love. And I say that because I'm going to strongly disagree with the thoughts that I'm hearing. Number one, the issue that we have in this country, in my opinion, is not a civil rights issue. Civil rights issue is an American issue, and as long as it falls under the law of a civil rights issue, you're never going to get anything done, because you're trying to go to the criminal to get justice, and as we all know, you're going to get criminal justice. The problem that we have is a human rights issue, and it's about justice for all, whether it be housing justice, whether it be economic justice. It's about justice. Number two, it's about finances in this country. On the back of every dollar bill, you see the God that they endure and that they love, and God we trust. That's the only God that they understand that they love. And because of the amount of dollars that they have, it's their belief that their God trust is at a higher level.
And Chuck, I'm sorry, but Chuck, I have to interrupt. I said when you first came on that we only had like a minute and a half left. We have to take a break here, and I appreciate you listening to the show and sharing your thoughts with everybody. I want to thank our guest here this hour. It's always a pleasure to have Akiba Solomon with us, who is editorial director for Color Lines. They do such a magnificent job at Color Lines, and we'll be, of course, linking to that on our website. Akiba, thanks so much for joining us, as always.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you with us. And Dr. Tara Bynum is with us, assistant professor in the Department of English at Towson University, has joined us here, and will be remaining with us for part of our discussion in the next half an hour. And as we're on our way to break here, a very brief break, so don't go away, really brief break, we're hearing Love Machine by The Miracles, hit number one on this day in 1976.
Just